from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, how does saliva work and why doesn't your stomach digest itself? And did constipation really kill Elvis Presley? In her new book, Gulp, Adventures on the Elementary Canal, Mary Roach chronicles a surprisingly exciting journey that food undertakes in the human body. She'll join us to talk about everything you ever wanted to know or might be disgusted to know about the digestive process with her usual array of interesting and unusual facts and stories and anecdotes. Her other books include Stiff, Spook, Bonk, and Packing for Mars. Mary Roach, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum Program. And in this Forum Hour, we welcome back Oakland-based author Mary Roach to the Forum Program, the author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Stiff, The Curious Life of Human Cadavers, and Packing for Mars, Curious Science of Life in the Void. She's most recently published Gulp, Adventures of the Elementary Canal, and glad to have you back on Forum. Welcome to the program. As I'd like to say by way of introduction, too, the last book I did was nominated along with Mary's for Best Nonfiction in Northern California. And I have to say, and I like to kid her about this, it's one thing to beat me. I mean, she beats me hands down. But to beat Mark Twain, that was was also nominated for Best Nonfiction. Let's talk about this new book of yours, though, and I thought maybe a good way to begin with this new weird science that you've given us is to start where you start with the UC Berkeley experiment back in 1968, where you had six guys inside of a metabolic chamber for a couple of days testing meals made from dead bacteria, and you say this kind of inspired you to write the book.
Well, it did in a strange way. I came across this when I was working on Packing for Mars, and it was I just love the reason this was done, I should say, is that scientists, people at NASA were thinking about a Mars mission. They were in that sort of optimistic stage of, well, first the moon and then quickly on to Mars. And so what will we eat? And they were trying to come up with something that would be easy to grow in a spacecraft on the way to Mars. And they thought, well, what could we farm on the astronauts' waste? What would be easy to grow? I know, bacteria. So they actually did try, and they sort of presented the bacteria. It was H. eutropha. It was presented as a slurry, and they didn't really the presentation sounded like it could have used some work, but it was it didn't go well. The title of the paper was Human Intolerance to Bacteria as Food, so nobody was forced to eat bacteria. But it just got me thinking of, I mean, we think of eating, you know, in the Bay Area, people obsess about food.
There's some more foodies here than probably any place.
Yeah, it's almost a religious experience, eating and the presentation of the food and the look of the food and the sensual qualities. But really, we are organisms taking in nutrients. And there's this whole other, the science of eating and the process of taking and breaking down food is kind of, you know, as soon as the food leaves the plate, nobody wants to think about it. And so I'm here to say, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. Once it gets past the lips, there's some pretty crazy stuff going on that's fun.
You think they did some kind of culinary presentations of this bacteria the way you see some restaurants do, fix it up?
they really should have. One of the dishes was described as having a halogen-like flavor, which it seems to me when you can identify the taste of street lighting, maybe you should take a break from experimental nutrition.
And by the way, we may be speaking of other things a little more icky, to use a word that Mary Roach uses in the course of this hour, than bacteria. So I don't know, if you have a sensitive stomach, you may want to hold off on eating your mid-morning snack until after this program. That's just a caveat. And you start off also talking about taste and olfactory being predominant, about 80-90%. And went and found this sensory analyst, a sensory forensic woman, Sue Langstaff, kind of a human bloodhound, really. how did you sniff her out, so to speak?
How did I find her? I don't remember how I... You know what it was? I okay, this is what happened. I turned in the book, and my editor felt that it was a little bottom heavy, that she wanted a little more above the waist, and I had a little imbalance in terms of the head and the tail. And so she said, why don't you do something on, I don't know, you're out in California, do something on wine, or I don't know. So I'm like, I was looking around, and I came upon the Olive Center up in UC Davis, and the Olive Center happened to be doing tryouts for an olive oil flavor panel. So I did that. And Sue Langstaff was the one who was recruiting.
You flunked, in fact, didn't you?
Thanks, Michael. Thanks. Yeah. 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 No, I did. At the end of the day, yeah, I got an email saying, hi, Mary, I hope you enjoyed the tryouts. Unfortunately, you did not make the cut. And I'm a very high achieving gal. So that was kind of
and
that
probably
was kind
a
of
good
brutal.
Smeller. I mean, you, I would imagine you have strong olfactory. But you really learn a lot about some people, obviously, like her, have great and almost inhuman skills with that. And you think about what dogs can do with their olfactory. And reading, thinking about how I got this image in my mind from your book about a dog sticking his head out a window. And you think about, oh, the dog likes the rush of air and so forth. No, the dog's sniffing everything around.
Yeah, it's a passive sniff because the air's being blown up the nose. Sue Langstaff rides a Harley. And one of the things she loves about it as a sensory analyst is that the air and all of the smells as she's going along, what is that road through Napa there, 29? All the smells from Gotts and from the place where they roast the boards for the barrels and the wineries and the muck on the river, she's almost sightseeing by smell. It's because it's being blown up her nose because you miss about 80%. Just breathing normally, you don't get the smells don't make it up to the top of the nasal cavity where the olfactory epithelium is. So you're missing out on most of the smells around you. So when you're riding, unless you're riding a Harley or you're sniffing or you're a dog with its head out the window.
And yet with humans, the visual and the cognitive, as you point out, those clues trump the olfactory, even though so much of taste is involved with the olfactory. We're better equipped for sight than sound.
Yeah, and that was demonstrated in a memorable experiment at the University of Bordeaux in France. There was a
this is the wine color thing.
Yeah. It's a known. It's not a new study, but I was interested to learn that they were fairly experienced wine people who did the study, where they had a red wine and a white wine, and they had to write down descriptors of the red and the white wine, and then they're presented with another set of red and white wine. However, in this case, the red is actually the white with a red coloring that doesn't affect the flavor added to it. And now, in this round, they describe this white wine with red wine descriptors because the visuals have trumped whatever their mouth and nose was telling them, even though they were experienced wine people.
Talking to Mary Roach, whose new book is called Gulp, Adventures in the Elementary Canal. And, I never thought of this. Well, many things I didn't think of that you make me think of when. But just the title, the subtitle, really, about the geography of our body, the aisles of the pancreas. You point out the isthmus of the thyroid, the straits and inlets of the pelvis. I mean, we're like a massive geography. And I think of you more an investigator of cosmos almost, because that's where you were in your last book, Packing for Mars, thinking about space and all. But we're a geography.
Yeah, and I love the early anatomists really dove into the body like explorers. And the names reflect that, the names that you were just mentioning. They really were, because it was the body was an unknown land, and they were discovering things and naming things and figuring things out. I love to think back to the time when no one really understood, how does a stomach do what it does? What's going on in this big long floppy tube, the intestine? What's going, what is it for? And somebody had to figure it out and to understand how it worked and what were the mechanisms. And that whole era of discovery I've always enjoyed.
So you're kind of the Magellan now of our contemporary period going into this, or Ponce de Leon or something like this. And actually, you have an enthusiasm. I mean, you have the comic gift as well when you write, but you have the enthusiasm. You talk about how miraculous saliva is and things of this sort, and I keep thinking to myself, this is almost like a spiritual experience for you in some ways, or something along those lines. It's like Einstein used to talk about the cosmos, just the amazing symmetry and extraordinary nature.
Well, I find that the researchers and the scientists that I speak to, I think I catch it from them because they have a very infectious passion and enthusiasm for the things that they study, even if what they're studying is spit. Or fecal matter, whatever it is, it's a world that so fascinates them and so inspires them that it rubs off on me. And then I want to share it with people because you come, you know, when you're not in that world, you just think
it rubs
of it
off
as,
on you. I'm
saying, no. Oh, sorry. Yeah. No. We'll take a shower now.
Yeah. They are the yeah. ones who influence you.
Right. Right. You can't help but sort of absorb a little bit of their enthusiasm.
Well, in fact, not to get too scatological, although you do from time to time, but when you're talking about, say, something like fecal transplants, which restore the necessary microbes, this is something that's icky, to use your word, in many people's minds. But it's also miraculous. It's extraordinary.
Oh, it is. It's rare that medicine comes up with a cure that is so effective, simple, inexpensive. I mean, that rarely happens. I should explain briefly. Fecal transplants are used to treat chronic infection in the bacteria in the intestine with C. difficile, which is a bacteria that can be, once it gets in there, if antibiotics don't knock it out the first few rounds, it's very hard to get rid of it. And you have chronic diarrhea, wasting. It's a miserable thing. 30,000 people per year in this country die from chronic C. difficile infection. And the treatment of fecal transplant is very, it's very simple. I was in Minneapolis. I was there for a procedure, which is very simple. There's a donor. It's a guy and nobody knows what's in his morning waste. Nobody knows what's in exactly which bacteria he's got, but it works. So he's this guy who's saving lives with the product of his morning toilet. And he comes in, you know, he's wearing a parka, he's got a bag. He hands it over. The morning I was there, he said, "Not my best work," and turned and left. But it worked. It cured the guy. And it's just that material's taken over to a lab where it's put under a fume hood. It's put in an Oster blender. And I called the Oster people, because I was curious how they felt about this use of their product. Because here they are, they're participating, and all these lives are being saved, and it's always the Oster company. They have the best blenders. And I thought maybe they should get some credit. And
Good of you to give them their props.
I got a note back saying, "Hi, Mary. After reaching out to our product development team, we've decided we prefer not to comment on this use of our product." And here I am.
Here you are.
Mentioning it on the airwaves.
Well,
much to their horror. But anyway.
Just keep getting publicity from you.
and Pyrex was, I think, in bonk. But anyway, but if fecal transplant, yeah, it's simple and effective. It's just you're taking a healthy microbiome, all the bacteria in a healthy gut, and you are putting them into someone who, you know, somebody who's taken antibiotics as a clean slate, and you're just, it's like immigration. You know, the bacteria from one land are immigrating into this new land, and it's very effective. Within 2 days, you start to see a remarkable turnaround. But what it was interesting to me about fecal transplants was the first one was done in the, I think it was back in the, I don't have the date in my head, but it was 50s or 60s. And so it's been known that this is an effective thing to do, but it's caught on very slowly, partly because of the ick factor. People, it seems intuitively wrong to put one person's waste into another person's body. But the other thing going on is that there's no pharmaceutical company that wants to spend the money to pay for the trials and the tests to get the procedure into the healthcare system because there's no product for them. It's free. It's waste. So there hasn't, it's taken a long time for it to get up to speed.
Well, it gives us a new appreciation for waste material. In fact, the same is true about saliva. I mean, you know, you get into spit and what it does for us and the whole digestive process and mastication and bowls.
What'd you say? Oh, bolus.
Well, I'm making the pun you made. Bowls of cherries I was thinking about.
Oh, yes. Life is a bolus of cherries.
Yeah, well, talk about the bolus.
The bolus. When you eat, I spent some time in the Netherlands at some researchers who study oral processing. And the mouth is a food processor. It's like a kind of a very sophisticated Cuisinart. The people don't really appreciate what's going on in there. The basic thing that you're doing in your mouth, you're taking the food apart and then you're reassembling it in a different shape. And the shape is a bolus. It's a cylindrical, moistened mass that's perfectly. It's in the swallowable state. That's the technical, the swallowable state, which I think Rhode Island should have on their license plate. Swallowable state. Anyway, so you're forming a bolus, and that, and it is very hard when you're eating to think about that and pay attention to it. It is, it's gross. It is just kind of a.
Do you think about that now when you eat?
I went through a period of a few weeks where, when I was doing that chapter, where yeah, and I'd be trying to. I came across a statistic that the minimum number of chews necessary to ready a McVitie's digestive biscuit for swallowing is 8, and I was just trying to best that. I think I can do it in 6, but they were right. It's very, very hard to. There's a certain amount of first you take it apart, and then you, and there's textbooks that have photographs of the whole process of taking it apart, putting it back together, you know, for different foods like meat, for cookies. It's a very weird and it's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Nobody and no one looks at it, and the researchers who do it are so surprised that you want to come to their lab and speak to them and spend time with them, because they're, I think they're kind of used to people not really respecting what they do.
Must have been thrilled to have you in there, really. I mean, we're talking to Mary Roach again, author of a new book called Gulp, Adventures on the Elementary Canal. I had kind of teased a few things in the billboard this morning, and maybe we ought to get to those. One of the questions I asked was, which you answer in the book, is why doesn't your stomach digest itself? And you learn a lot about the way the stomach operates. I mean, stomach lining is kind of a fascinating subject just in itself.
The stomach, well, the stomach, yeah, you have a something called the mucus layer. The mucus layer. The mucus layer. Didn't Jane Doornacher do a whole routine on the mucus layer?
I don't remember, but
I think she
remember
did.
Jane quite fondly.
I think she, yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing the, anyway, you have the mucus layer, and that's a protective, that's a protective layer that's protecting the stomach itself. The stomach lining is also very efficient at rebuilding itself. I'm told you have a new lining every few days, which is kind of a.
That's kind of cool
kinda
to think
cool.
about, yeah.
And the stomach's got a lot of protective mechanisms that keep it from rupturing, no matter how much you eat, you know, even if you're a competitive eater or if you're bulimic. There are some people who really put the stomach, really stress the stomach. But the stomach will, it will do, there's a couple of reflexes. One is the, I love this, the transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxation. That is?
A burp.
A burp.
Yeah.
Bingo. Yeah. So there's that. It's, and that's particularly if you've got a lot of gas building up for some reason in your stomach, and that builds up quickly, and that can put a lot of pressure on the stomach and put you at risk of a rupture. So you burp and you get rid of the gas. And
Can I bring my mother into this discussion? She
used
to say
do.
Better to belch and be in shame than not to belch and be in pain.
That's
good.
That's
mother wisdom.
That's good. I've got a mother wisdom for you. This was my friend Stephanie Gold's mother said, never say excuse me louder than you fart. That's a good one, right?
Shall we talk about flatulence for a moment? No, in fact,
yes. Let's talk about flatulence.
Well, it's always fascinated me why young boys, particularly, are so fascinated with flatulence. There really is a gender divide there.
Young boys and Mary Roach.
Well, yes.
Who is essentially a young boy?
Well,
packaged in the body of a middle-aged
inner
woman.
Young boy,
yeah.
Obviously. But no, but just the idea of, in fact, somebody you said, what do you do about the noxious smells of flatulence? Said, get yourself a dog and blame the dog. It's very funny.
Yes, that was one gastroenterologist. We were just having this long discussion. He goes, you know what I tell these people? Get a dog.
So, well, not necessarily to dwell on flatulence or burping here, but I did also tease this program by saying, talking about did constipation really kill Elvis?
Sounds like a Sarah Valbo, constipation, constitution.
Well, our body is a constitution too, as well as geographical terrain. Let's talk about Elvis's death.
Sure, yeah.
Because you do, you write
I
about
do.
It.
Yeah, no, I spent an afternoon with Elvis's longtime Dr. Nicopoulos.
That's the one who gave him the pills, in fact.
Yeah, Needles Nick. He did a lot of prescribing of prescription, a lot of prescription drugs. Elvis was on a tremendous load of uppers and downers and appetite suppressants and all manner of prescription drugs. Elvis had a serious long-time battle with constipation. When he died, his colon was 3 times the diameter of an average man of his size, and he had a tremendous obstruction. What had killed him was it was a fatal heart arrhythmia, and the medical term, and this happens every now and then when somebody's straining too hard, defecation associated sudden death is the medical term, and that is
eat your fiber.
In ICU units in heart people, heart patients are put on as a matter of course on stool softeners, partly because they want to avoid this, and you're using a bedpan, which is a very difficult way to go to the bathroom. It's not natural. You have to push a lot harder. So there's a concern with that. And Elvis Presley was trying to, you know, he was straining, as they say, very, very, giving it all he could. And obviously drugs, all particularly painkillers and some of those psychiatric drugs slow down gut motility. So that's contributing. And it's not clear whether that was what led to the big backup or whether he had a congenital. There's something called Hirschsprung's, which is when you're the far end of the colon doesn't have the nerves, which would make the contractions that move the waste along. So it backs up and you have this tremendous backlog, kind of log jam. And had they known, if that were the case, there is surgery. You can remove that paralyzed portion of the colon.
And it could have saved him.
And that could have saved him.
And he wouldn't be in Dearborn where he is now, according to the latest sighting, I think.
Is he in Dearborn?
I don't think so. Talking to Mary Roach, author of Gulp. You know, I also couldn't help thinking about a lot of the, when you talk about things like, you know, scatological things or flatulence or whatever, you get into these strange cultural taboos. I think it's a movie, one of Louis Bunuel's movies. I think it's The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, where these people come in and they eat in private. But they use the toilet in front of each other, you know, and sort of like...
Oh, the inversion of the usual taboo.
Yeah.
Yes.
To suggest that those taboos maybe just be kind of arbitrary.
Yeah. Know? And eating, I mean, one of the little things I mentioned in the book is that eating by oneself in a public place is a very uncomfortable thing. To be the only person, say, on a morning subway car train eating something with everyone around you, in Japan, very much so. I felt very uncomfortable eating in public there. And when I was at NASA for Packing for Mars, there was the guy who does NASA TV, which is a very sort of often just raw feed from mission control, and they'll just leave the camera on. And he said, well, we'll leave it on, but if the camera happens to be on somebody who takes their lunch out of their desk drawer and they start to eat a sandwich, we'll quietly move the camera, because it's almost like pornography just to see this organism putting nutrients into its mouth and grinding them up. It's kind of a gross thing that we do. But we go out to a restaurant and there's noise and laughter and chatter and we're focused on the conversation, and you don't really look at people's mouths and what they're doing. But I did, because I'm writing the book, and it can really skeeve you out a little bit.
Skeeve you out?
Isn't that
a new verbal phrasing I haven't heard? You're talking
to Mary
Roach. Let me take this opportunity before we go to our break to invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation. A number of ways you can do that. The new book is Gulp, and you may want to talk about digestion from the time, and you may have some questions about the way we take food in, the way we masticate it, and the way we swallow it, and the whole process going down the alimentary canal and peristalsis movement, all those kinds of things until... of course, the evacuation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have and join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking with the inimitable Mary Roach. And by the way, I'll be talking with her tomorrow night at Dominican College about 7 p.m. We're going to talk about Packing to Mars. And that's a free event in San Rafael. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Mary Roach, who is the author of Gulp, Adventures in Food Digestion, and actually it's called Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Her other books include Stiff, Spook, Bonk, and Packing for Mars. She'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6:30, and will be with me at Dominican University tomorrow night as part of the One Book, One Marin series that Dominican has. She has a number of other upcoming events in the Bay Area, so check her website, maryroach.net, for more details. You become a star, really. You are a star now.
Ah, pshaw.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, people love your writing and really respond to it. And that's the great part. But they also, maybe as great, respond to you. And were you kind of a nerdy science student as a kid? Or were you just always kind of cracking wise, too?
No, I was a really shy kid. I was very shy. I never got invited to parties in high school. I got straight A's.
You never got invited to parties?
I got all Scottish there.
No,
I never got invited.
I
wasn't a wisecracking kid. I was a real nerd. I was really skinny. I had braces.
This is New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, yeah. Small town New Hampshire. So until I got out and went to college.
Is that when you became a babe?
That's when it all happened.
Yeah.
It all kicked in then, yeah.
And it continues to kick in. Before we go to our listeners here, I want to talk about hooping, which is rectal smuggling into prisons, because you spend a good deal of time on it, and it's kind of a strangely fascinating subject. They call it OD, Office Depot, in fact, at one point. Storage bin fundament is what I call it.
Yeah, there was one guy at I was over at Avenal State Prison, which is down a ways in the valley, and one of the captains there in the prison told me about a guy. They caught him with 3 jumbo binder rings, a stapler, some staples, some pens, and a box of paper clips, I think it was. And they never figured out why, what he was going to do with them. But he became known as OD for Office Depot.
It's amazing what people can put in that area of their anatomy.
No,
Ripley's stuff.
It is. There are roundups in the medical journals every now and then, and most of them coming, of course, from emergency rooms. And the category that's always most astounding is when there's more than one item. It's called, in this paper anyway, they deemed it collections.
There
are an astounding assortment of items. It's almost just like in prisons, it's another back pocket. And if you watch the footage from visitor rooms, the visitor room where the families visit with the inmates, every now and then they'll catch a guy. There's one guy, he's playing a board game with his son. His wife hands him a little bundle, and I don't know if it was drugs or cash or what it was. And he just reaches back as though he's putting his wallet in his back pocket with no change in facial expression, just slips it in. It's kind of a fact of life in a prison setting.
Well, you learn a lot about the facts of life in this book, at least how we eat and how we excrete and all that, and all kinds of just wonderful facts that are fascinating and so strange in so many strange ways. Human hair can be used to make fake soy sauce.
It has been. Human hair is a source, an excellent source of L-cysteine, which is used in commercial baking to get the dough to be the right texture. It's also used in as a meat flavoring, kind of a brothy flavoring. It's something you can get from either hair or feathers. And there was a concern at one point that hair was being, in India, sometimes hair is cut and made as an offering in a temple. Long hair is cut off and given as an offering. And some of the people who run the temples were then profiting by selling the hair. And there was a concern that some of the hair was being sold to make flavorings or in the baking industry. So it came to pass that someone went in and investigated to see, is human hair kosher? And they did determine that human hair is kosher. Of course, the hair is processed. It doesn't look, when you make L-cysteine, you would never be able to see its origins were hair. You would never know. But anyway.
Human hair of Gentiles' heads is also kosher?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact.
And before we go to our callers and emailers, and again, you can join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org if you have a question or comment for Mary, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. But of all the ick stuff, you said that the most revolting experience you had was with competitive eating.
Mm-hmm. Competitive eating. Well, it was in.
So these guys will swallow all these hot dogs and that's
hot dogs. 18 pounds of cow brains, 4 pounds. Interestingly, when you go by poundage, the reckoner is often at 8 to 10 pounds. Fruitcake, no one has made it past 4 pounds.
Huh.
Nobody's ever made it past 4 pounds. Anyway, I was interested.
We get the fruitcakes for Christmas and throw them out half the time.
Sorry. Yeah, I think they're
so
just
used to do in my house.
But. They're so dense that nobody can eat more than 4 pounds of them. Anyway, I was interested in the stomach. It's very, very difficult to rupture a human stomach. It's an incredibly got an amazing number of self-preservation mechanisms. And I was curious, how does a competitive eater work around that? And I interviewed a guy, Eric the Red Denmark, who was, I believe, ranked number 6 at the time. And I said, how do you, given that the stomach has this reflex to empty itself, to regurgitation is a protective reflex. If you eat it past that point where if you're threatening to rupture your stomach will regurgitate. And I said, well, how do you keep that from happening? He said, oh, we don't. We just swallow it back down because the rule is it can come up. It just can't come out. So you would – part of the mental challenge is to do things like that, to be able – well, first of all, you're pushing past – way past where you are uncomfortable.
Zen and the Art of Controlling Vomitus.
Yeah, it is a very – it's a sort of a Zen practice, or as he put it, it's mental. Like, yeah, I'll say. But yeah, it is – it's a lot of the training. And these aren't people with larger than average stomachs. There was a Dr. Metz in – I believe he was in Philadelphia. I may have that wrong. Anyway, he brought in a competitive eater and a normal, regular eater and put them in front of a fluoroscope, gave them a plate of hot dogs and a side of barium so it would show up on the fluoroscope, and he watched what was going on as they were eating. And the competitive eater, he didn't have a larger stomach, but he had a very, the term is compliant. It just balloons out. So these are people, their whole lives, they've been able to just eat tremendous amounts and not suffer ill effects. They have a very compliant stomach. But even then, they practice. There's a lot of training that goes on. A lot of it mental, yes.
Let's go to your phone calls. And we go first to Alana. Good morning.
Good morning. Bringing it back to the scatological aspect, being a parent of a young child, it's fascinating to me how we move from potty training and congratulating our child to pooping on the toilet to suddenly, you know, they get to a certain age where I guess they start to realize that, oh, I need to do this behind closed doors. So I don't know if there's necessarily anything to comment back on that, but it's something sort of interesting that I, as a parent, we spend so much time thinking about poop. Did they poop? Are they going to poop? Are they going to be constipated? And on. So that's just from my perspective.
Yeah, that it is interesting how, well, children come into the world without a sense of disgust. It's not an, it's not, and this applies also to what we feed children. You can set in front of children. There was a study done in Paul Rosin, University of Pennsylvania, set out plates with foods that we adults would say are disgusting, set them in front of kids 16 to 29 months, I believe, with the range, and a sterilized grasshopper, artificial poop, dog poop. It was made with coiled peanut butter and maybe some refried beans with Limburger cheese for the scent. Very, apparently quite high fidelity, really looked and smelled like dog poop. And it was presented to them, here's some dog poop, and the kids would pick it up and eat it. We don't, you know, we don't have this disgust. It is put upon us by the culture, by our family, the people that are around us, and culture and media. And it's just so interesting to look at what other cultures do and don't think is disgusting.
Well, it reminds me of a study that was done, this is kind of an odd study, but with really preschool kids in the UK, and they gave them all these names and they said, which name do you think is prettier? And overwhelmingly, they chose the name diarrhea as the prettiest name. They didn't have a concept of what it was.
It's a beautiful word. Yeah. Word. Diarrhea.
Let me thank the caller and go to more of your calls. From Half Moon Bay, Danny joins us on forum. Good morning, Danny.
Hi.
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 Mary, I'm a big fan of yours. I read all of your books. But
thank you.
That's secondary to the point that I want to make. One, you're clearly a genius. And two, how do you come up with such a diversity of topics upon which to write?
Well, I have to take issue with the genius thing. But thank you. That's very nice of you. But I think what I kind of work backwards. I have like for this book, for example, I had years ago. I went to the Beano company for a story, and I wasn't allowed to have very much fun with the story I was writing, so I knew I had this fun material. I'd also spent some time up in the Arctic for a different story that had to do with the Inuit foods. And so I had this sort of cluster of things that I thought would be fun to write about. And then I looked for an umbrella topic that would allow me to go to these different places. So I sometimes work backwards, but it's a random process, and I'm not very good at it. And I'm always wanting for new book ideas. That's for me is the hardest part.
I thought maybe the hardest part would be coming up with these titles. So I mean, you have to get those kind of onomatopoeic sounds.
Yeah, Packing for Mars. We couldn't do it. We were stumped.
We couldn't do it. No.
Couldn't come up with one.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in a moment. But you're right. And again, I think a lot of people are curious about how you get on the trail of these kinds of things. You do a lot of research. You do a prodigious amount of research. But, for example, how do you find Richard Terry in that whole story about the superworm and the bullfrog? It sounds like a Mark Twain title again. We're back to Mark Twain, you know.
Dick Tracy.
The beetle larva thing.
The beetle, right. I started out with Jonah, the Jonah story, because I was a kid. My mom would read from her Bible.
Impossible, right? For the whale to have swallowed Jonah and to live in the stomach?
A sperm whale is your best bet because they feed by suction, so you could be taken into the stomach. There's big enough hole opening for a man to fit in there because they feed on quite large squid. And there's no gastric acid, so you'd be okay. So say you had a scuba tank in there. You'd be okay except for one thing in the sperm whale, the stomach. They kind of chew with their stomach. There are these muscular contractions, so it would be very uncomfortable, to say the least. But I think you might survive for a little while. But anyway, from
Sorry,
the Jonah.
Ken, I'm thinking about the Gershwin Larry. He made his home in that fish's abdomen.
That's a great line.
Very unlikely, yeah.
So. Anyway.
Not a fish, it's a mammal, but anyway. Yeah.
So from Jonah, I progressed to other, like an oyster. What is it like for a live oyster in a human stomach? And then I was curious, is there any organism other than a parasite? Because everybody knows parasites are their life cycle puts them within different parts of different bodies. But setting aside parasites, I wondered, is there any organism that could survive inside someone else's stomach? And there's this rumor on that somebody said, oh yeah, mealworm. The mealworm in a lizard's stomach will eat its way out. And this is a very persistent internet rumor. And there's a biologist at the University of Nevada in Reno, Richard Tracy, who, because of his research, has a lab full of frogs and lizards and he said he's going to test it. So we actually did an experiment using a urethral endoscope, which is a very narrow endoscope, so we could spy on the mealworm in the stomach of lizard, frog. We had two different animals, and in fact they go in and they immediately go inert. And they're not dead because we pulled them back out and they recover. The mealworms recovered, but there was no eating out. It was 4 or 5 times we looked at this. So I think it's pretty well debunked. But it was a very persistent rumor on the internet. It was just very fun that he was like, I think we can test this. I know some people who can borrow a urethral endoscope, and we've got some lighting. We can figure out a way to do this. And so we did. I went up to the lab and we spent an afternoon with
another guy who was excited probably to see you and have your attention. And we'll get attention to more callers. Jane, join us. Hi.
Hi. I heard you on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, and you said something about dish soap and cleaning products sharing some of the same enzymes. I think it's enzymes.
Yes.
That are in the digestive system. And when I was early on in my pregnancy, we had just a regular thing of dish soap that every time I got near it, I thought I was going to throw up. And I had to tell my husband, get it away. Just go put it somewhere else. We have to get something different. And I always thought that was really strange. And when I heard you talk about that, I thought, oh, I've got to figure out a way of getting in touch with her and asking her. And I don't know if there's a connection to what you were saying, or I have a very sensitive gag reflex. If I see a piece of moldy bread, my throat closes up. So maybe it's just an individual constitution.
So you weren't consuming the dish.
No, you were smelling it, just the sight of it? No. It was if I smelled it.
Oh, oh. Huh. Well, I don't know that it would have to do with the enzymes. It was probably just some of those soaps have, I find, have a very powerful smell, aroma. I mean, there's some of those hand cleaning. There's one from Trader Joe's. It's a lavender one that my husband likes. And it just, to me, it smells like this awful men's cologne. I can smell him across the room. So possibly it was just a very overwhelming, unappealing smell. But I'm glad that passed.
Yeah, I guess I thought it was so interesting what you said about that, the ability to remove stains, I guess, was...
Laundry detergent that has, if it says enzymatic action, the enzymes are the same things your digestive tract is using to break down food, because the foods that you put in your mouth, you're also spilling in your lap. So it makes sense. There's a lipase, proteinase, and amylase, proteins, starches, and fats. So those are, they're not from a human digestive tract. They can genetically engineer. Yeah, they can figure out ways to do it more efficiently. But anyway, though, they are digestive enzymes.
And Jane, thank you for the call. Here are some emails kind of giving you props with respect to maybe, for example, Karen says, I think there needs to be more conversation around these topics. As someone who suffers from ulcerative colitis, I can't wait to read Mary's book and applaud her efforts. Another listener, Estrella, writes, I've heard Mary Roach on The Daily Show and now on forum. She has such great information to share. And as a Sjogren's patient whose body doesn't produce saliva, it's so important for people to know how detrimental this disease is from a GI tract point of view. Thank you for this great topic.
So, yes.
Helping people out there, too. And Griselda, I always love that name. It's right out of Chaucer. To help proper digestion, when is the best time to drink water, before, during, or after a meal?
Well, the hot dog folks, the competitive eaters, are taking it.
They're taking water in
with it. Because they're using it just as a moistening agent. But I don't know of any particular benefit to. But I drink it with the meal. But I think really, any time you drink water is good. I don't have a timing. I don't have a schedule for anybody.
See, there's a peril in writing a book like this. People are going to come up to your parties now and say, I've had this constipation problem or something.
I know.
Wanting advice and wisdom from you. Here's a listener who says, how much saliva does a body typically create per day, and what mechanism delivers it to the mouth, and why do I wake up with a fresh batch every day?
About 2 to 3 pints a day. Most of it parotid saliva, which is the stimulated kind that happens when you chew. It comes pretty quickly from these glands, and it helps you to form the bolus. That's one thing it's doing. But interestingly, also, the person who wrote, who had the Sjogren's, I think that's the pronunciation. The other important thing saliva does is, when you eat something acidic, cola, orange juice, wine, vinegar, you've got this, that acid range can dissolve the enamel of the teeth. So when you do, you take a swallow of wine, if you're paying attention, there's a gush of saliva comes in. And what's that do? It's diluting the acid and it's protecting your teeth. And when you don't have enough saliva, your teeth start to really deteriorate quickly. So saliva is essential, not just for moistening, but it's doing.
But what about dry mouth? I mean, sometimes you wake up with almost seems like there's no saliva.
Well, that's because your mouth breathing. Your
just
mouth falls
of respiration,
open.
Yeah.
Yeah, your mouth falls open and that contributes to tooth decay as well, because you don't have the saliva dries out. So what can you do about that, though? Strap your mouth shut.
There you go.
I guess.
Here's Steve, who says, great show. Please talk about total transit time. Mine is 21 hours, not 20, not 22. You can set your watch by my peristatic process. My wife works as a rep for a major GI supplier. Mary should see the stuff we get in our mail, especially the journals and magazines, and FedEx brings packages every other day. Last year, she brought home from a conference a poster of the Bristol Stool Scale.
It's in my book.
And how he ends this? And may everyone have a good BM today.
That's great. 21 transit time. I wonder if he did the... You can do a simple experiment. You can measure your own transit time, your personal transit time, by eating peanuts or corn, because those little chunks of them will pass all the way through undigested. So you can time it from the time you eat them to the time they arrive in the in the toilet, and then you can you too can know your transit time. I had heard around 30 hours, so 21 is good. That's a good quick turnaround time.
Thousands of people there sitting with their stopwatches as they munch on peanuts. Here's John in Antioch who says, I'm dieting, trying to lose weight, and so I was wondering how much the stuff in my GI tract contributes when I weigh on the scale each morning.
Oh, as in if you ate a pound of food for breakfast,
yeah,
do you?
I think that's what he says.
Right.
Yeah.
I've often wondered, there was a guy, this wonderful, oh, now his name is escaping me, in the 1600s, this guy who built a great big scale with a dinner table on it, and he sat and he ate meals and looked at how, you know, looked at how his weight would change. And he figured out, it's called insensible perspiration, where you're losing moisture through your pores and through breathing. And he figured out that has to be factored in. But, if you take in a pound of food, you're going to weigh a pound more until you empty the food. I don't have any precise answer for that, but.
Here's Chuck who says, I heard your guest interviewed on another show, so I understand what makes flatulence so generally unpleasant. But as a bean and rice lover, I'm curious whether she knows if soaking dried beans before cooking really helps, and if so, why?
I have heard that it does help, and I've also heard that it doesn't help as much as you think it helps. Those are the two things I've heard. And I don't know why it should help, because the reason that beans contain oligosaccharides, which is a kind of complex carbohydrate that isn't broken down in the small intestine. It gets passed on down the line into the colon, where the bacteria go to town. They break it down, and in that process, they produce gas, lots of gas, mostly hydrogen. And
beans are supposed to be the musical fruit, but I think broccoli is worse, isn't it?
Not in terms of volume. Broccoli is bad in terms of smell.
Yeah.
And all the cruciferous vegetables, a lot of sulfur compounds, which so the smell component of flatus is tiny. It's mostly, you know, hydrogen and methane have no odor. They're just the volume of the gas. So I don't know why soaking should, because the oligosaccharides are still there. They're not breaking down in water. So I don't know the answer to why that should help.
I heard people complaining about the fact that sugar-free candy, I don't know what they put in there, but, you know,
Sorbitol or something.
Yeah, that causes a great deal of flatulence.
Yeah, there was a substance, mannitol, that used to be used to flush out the colon before a colonoscopy. But mannitol, the bacteria would break it down, and so it would create gas. So there were some unfortunate cases of explosions in the colon when somebody the doctor went to cauterize the polyp, because the mannitol, the bacteria had feasted on this mannitol and created a lot of hydrogen in the bowel. So that was a terrible.
And here's a listener who described who signs her email as Gassy Cassie and says, As I've gotten older, I've gotten ever more gaseous. No matter what the food I ingest, healthy or otherwise, my stomach seems to be turning into gas. It's uncomfortable and embarrassing. I've made changes to milk by drinking lactate, but that doesn't really seem to help. Beano and Gas Easy doesn't seem to help. My gastro guy said it's just part of getting older. Is it really?
Yes, they're all the body parts, the colon gets flabbier, the muscles get flabbier. That means they balloon more. So when you have gas in the colon, the way that you feel pain in the colon is not by cutting or by heat. You don't feel that. But when it stretches, the stretch receptors are activated, and that translates to pain. So when you have gas that's ballooning your colon, that hurts. And it happens more the older you get, unfortunately.
Getting a lot of questions about fecal transplant, about how it's administered to the patient with difficulties. In fact, let me get a caller on here. I think, Terry, you're on that point, aren't you? Hi.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Mary, you're a delight, a breath of fresh air, so to speak, on some of these icky subjects.
Thank you.
My husband has C. diff, and we're very interested in what you have to say about the fecal transplant, and loved your story earlier.
Terry, forgive me. I'm sorry for breaking in here, but I was just handed that CNN is reporting that there is an arrest in the Boston bombing case, and just wanted to alert you to that and to stay tuned to KQED for the latest from NPR News. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
We're curious about how the fecal transplant is administered. You had a great story, and you took it up to the man delivering the specimen.
Yes.
To the hospital in Minneapolis. Then what happened?
Oh, right. I know. I left you hanging. Okay. Well, it's processed very simply in a blender with distilled water. You don't want tap water because you don't want any chlorine to kill the bacteria. And then it's administered with the same colonoscope that's used for a colonoscopy. It's a flexible tube that has the camera on the end. And there's a, you can have an attachment with a plunger that just delivers the material, which, and the material is, it looks like coffee with low fat milk in it. And it's very, you know, it's about a, is it a cup of material? It's a substantial amount, but it's just put into the large intestine all the way up to the boundary with the small intestine. And it's very, it takes 2 minutes. And it's done with just the same sedation you would have for a colonoscopy. It's very simple.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very simple and very, very 90-something percent cure rate.
Yes, so, we've heard that.
Yeah, so, and there are more and more physicians, gastroenterologists who are doing this. And you, if you want to contact me through my email, I mean, through my website, maryroach.net, I could try to help you get in touch with someone.
Thank you, Terry. Let me get another quick caller on here. Gary, who's reading Gulp as we speak, or at least right before we started speaking. Gary, welcome.
Something like that. I'm going to be a sycophant for you, Mary. I love your stuff, something about it. I always want to know how everything works ever since I was a kid. I read everything. I have books on how things work, and your books just work for me. They crack me up. I love your humor and the information. I have one question for you, though. I just also read a book called Erasing Death, and of course I read Spook, and I read Erasing Death. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
No, but, I'm not.
It was written by a doctor. In fact, I heard the guy on Fresh Air, and he's doing a lot of death research based on resurrection, medical resurrection technology, and it kind of refutes, and I wouldn't say refutes, it augments Spook. So you could read it and revise Spook with some fascinating info. Please keep it up.
We'll let the sycophancy as well as the recommendation stand because we're flat.
Thank you so much.
Out of time here. And
thank you, Gary.
Thank you so much, Mary Roach. Always a delight to be with you. And your curiosity is obviously insatiable, and it's done so many readers wonders and provided great entertainment as well as important knowledge. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.